So I think we should start anyway. There might be people coming a bit late. Obviously, some are having problems, technical problems, more entering university than I think with the computer. But let's see how things develop through that morning session. So welcome everyone to that webinar by Dan Southers in the context of Naples. Let me quickly introduce Dan to you, and then I think everyone else could introduce him or herself, and then Dan will have a kind of presentation, and then there will be a discussion. So hi, Joe, good to see you. We will try your setup or your microphone a bit later. So Dan Southers, I mean, the scope of his research is cognitive, social, and computational perspectives on designing and evaluating software for learning, collaboration, and community. This is the broadest possible description, I think, of his work. I think his main research interests lie in three different fields. One is the social affordances for online communities. A second one is the appropriation of tools for intersubjective meaning making, and I think we will hear a little bit, especially also on this aspect of CSCL. And a third emphasis of his research, and actually this was the one that I learned to know first, was the one about representational affordances for computer-supported collaborative learning. So different kinds of representations that are used in the context of computer-supported collaborative learning, and how these affects cognition, discourse, and also other process and outcome variables. His research is in the context of three different areas. He's doing research in secondary school science education. He's also doing research in post-secondary education and professional development of adult educators, but he's also doing laboratory studies. I think that is a very broad and interesting approach, which is also quite specific to CSCL, I think. His education, he started with a bachelor's degree in fine arts. Then he got that from Kansas City Art Institute. Then he studied psychology at Northern Arizona University. And then he studied and got his master's degree in computer science at the University of Massachusetts with a dissertation entitled The Analysis of Explanation and Its Implications for the Design of Explanation Planners. He got also his PhD in computer science from the University of Massachusetts. He's currently a professor in the Department of Information and Computer Science at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He was the program chair of the program Communication and Information Sciences, a PhD program, which is also relevant to the Naples context, I think. He's also one of the most cited scholars in the area of the learning sciences. I think he has one paper in the International Journal of the Learning in the International Journal of Computer-Supported Collaborative Learning, who has been the most cited paper over the last couple of years. He was also, or has been, very active for the International Society of the Learning Sciences. He served as associate editor, editorial board member of all of the journals that the society has. He also was a program, a conference committee chair, and chaired several different aspects of the different conferences that the society entertains. And I think that was it, what I would like to say to introduce Dan. So welcome, Dan. And I would think that it would now be time to have you introduce yourself. I mean, the participants say hello, test the equipment at the same time, but also say maybe a little bit, say your name and the institution that you're from, and maybe one or two words in addition, please.
So while Joe is trying to get his microphone working, we say hello from Munich. This is Daniel. I'm a graduate student at the Reason program here, and I'm interested into mathematics education and the facilitation of argumentational skills.
Hi there, this is Fides, also from LMU. I'm really interested in several things as Daniel is, and looking forward to our web conference today or our webinar today.
Hi, this is also from LMU, and I'm Carlos and Christian.
I'm Heather.
Yeah, and well, I'm interested in computer learning, especially what involves video games and learning.
And I'm interested in medical education.
And I'm a master's student in the learning sciences.
Yeah, nice to see you.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I'm a PhD candidate at Sydney University, and I work at Macquarie University, the Learning and Teaching Centre. I'm interested in group collaboration across computer, but also face-to-face, see how people collaborate in the real world.
Hi, everyone, again. I'm Chris Lund from the University of Lyon, and we were going to wait for Claire, who is on her way, but she'll maybe present herself later, or I can say that she's a PhD student in educational sciences working on the role of argumentation in discussions about social scientific issues and emotional aspects related to argumentation. For myself, I'm interested right now in how epistemologies, different epistemologies, are brought to bear on the study of human interaction. And I'll pass over to Greg.
I'm Greg Dyke. I'm a postdoc at the University of Lyon. And I'm interested in how we can develop methods to analyze interaction process data.
Sorry, Joe, still no sound. So maybe you use the chat in the meantime. And we go on to Vasilis. Hi, Vasilis. Could you try to speak? We have no video from you, Vasilis. But if you press the start broadcasting or join queue button, then you would be next to introduce yourself. Vasilis, can you hear us? Could you type something into the chat, maybe? So, seem to be still technical problems. Maybe you can work on that and introduce yourself a bit later, and so that we can start with Dan. Dan, the floor is yours.
Okay. Aloha from Honolulu. We just got a note in the chat from Joe. Just drawing attention to that. Okay, I was, I had a, yeah, Joe is John O. from the University of Nottingham, if you didn't catch that. Yeah, I had a chat with Frank about what this was about, and he said that basically the previous sessions, what he learned from them is that I should not talk too long, but I should talk some, I should leave some time for discussion, and that I should start really with the basics. Some of you are quite advanced in the area of CSCL, and others of you I don't know, so I'm worried that this is too basic. My life has been very absorbed in a big project this semester, so I don't have fancy slides. I just have a plain text outline that was sent to you via an URL, and so I'm going to follow through that. That's, you know, kind of my outline of main points I want to make in introducing CSCL as an area of study and what issues there are in CSCL. And the webpage I sent has readings that go into quite a bit more detail on some of these things. So I'm going to go through kind of in chunks, approximately where there's a horizontal line in the document. I will stop broadcasting to see if anybody wants to bring anything up. But the first chunk is very brief. Just what is CSCL? Well, if we just look at the terms, you know, we have computer-supported collaborative learning. So learning, traditional definition of learning is a change in behavior as a result of experience. But as we'll see below, there's many other conceptions of learning, and there's different ideas about what the agent of learning is. So collaboration in CSCL, there has been actually there's a diversity of ideas about what people do together, but there's been an ongoing thread of this concept that came from Rochelle and Teasley of maintaining a joint conception of a problem, that collaboration is when a group of people work tightly together and there's evidence that they are trying to make sure that they have the same conception and develop their conception of the problem together. And that's in contrast with cooperation or approaches where people divide up the work, go off and do their part, and then come and bring them back together. But if you actually, if you look at the CSCL literature, you know, in practice, you see both of these. So any generalizations, you know, that I make about CSCL probably are not true, or you'll find exceptions. So then there's a question of computer. Well, computer supported, well, we broadly understand it to mean all information communication technologies, or ICTs. And actually, I see a lot of work in CSCL and insights applying to other technologies as well. For example, I will make a point later on that some of the strategies that are studied in the area of scripting aren't specific to CSCL necessarily. They're more about how can you build structures that guide learning, and that could be done with you know, paper-based technology. And then that, of course, brings up a question of what to be CSCL. Does it have to involve computers? Does it have to involve digital technologies? There's a lot of papers in CSCL by in certain traditions that don't really look at technology at all. They look just at how people learn in groups, and then that might inform what you do with technology. Then there's the term supported, computer-supported collaborative learning. So what are different ideas of support? And I'll get into this more later on. So the ICT can be the medium of interaction. If you're doing computer-mediated communication, or CMC, that can be synchronous or asynchronous. But technology can also support face-to-face learning. Technology can offer resources for learning, you know, media that offer information. They can be, they can structure learning processes, be a guide, and of course be an object of study. So there are actually different conceptions of what CSCL is, and in the next section I'll go into some of these different conceptions from the point of view of how learning takes place in social settings. I'll just transition into that with one of my favorite definitions of CSCL due to Tim Koshman, which is that it's a field centrally concerned with meaning and practices of meaning-making in the context of joint activity and the ways in which these practices are mediated through designed artifacts. And you'll see in a minute that not everybody studies it this way. Not everybody studies meaning and practices of meaning-making. Some people study more individual change, like through you know, pretest, potest design, where you're testing individuals' knowledge and things like that. So it's not a sufficient definition for capturing everything that CSCL is, but there it is one of the kind of general core ideas of CSCL. And then the ways that practices are mediated through designed artifacts. Notice that artifacts doesn't necessarily have to mean digital technology, and mediated can mean different things. You know, does it structure it? Is it just the medium of communication? Does it offer resources? And so I'll get into that a bit more later. So I'm just going to pause briefly to see if there's any questions at this point, and then after that I will go into more detail on starting with different views of learning in social settings. Okay, I guess if there's nobody, I'm still getting used to this flash meeting technology. I just realized that if somebody did have something to say, you probably would have pushed the button and then there would be it would show in the queue. So feel free to do that if, you know, I say something that you want to comment on or ask about, and I will stop at the next good break point. I guess maybe I should just check in one question for Frank real quickly. What is our end time? I forgot to ask you that.
So we have 90 minutes overall. So the end time would be in 1 hour, 9 minutes from now.
Okay, thanks. So I will try to leave substantial time for interaction. So learning in social settings. So if CSCL is about collaborative learning, setting aside the question of whether it's whether it has to be maintaining a joint conception of a problem or it's more like the cooperative model, let's just ask, you know, how does learning take place in a social setting? How does a social setting help learning? And this depends on your ideas about agency, about who or what learns, and epistemology, which is, I'm using that term because in its traditional sense it means the acquisition of knowledge, but just that phrase that I just used already has presumptions about what learning is. Coming to have knowledge or skills is one view of learning. So agency and epistemology. So agency, we can think of course, individuals as being the unit of learning, the agent that learns. But there's also views in CSCL that it's small groups are the agent of learning, and larger entities, networks of people, communities, or just more loosely affiliated networks. Community has a lot of connotations, you know, nice, fuzzy, happy things associated with the word that aren't necessarily there, cultures, societies. So there's these different levels of collectivity of agency or individuals. And then there's different epistemologies, and this is not an exhaustive list. Other people probably, there might be other things that people think of, but this is kind of the way I parse out what CSCL is about. And by the way, this part of my presentation, and actually much of my presentation, is worked out in detail in the paper that Frank mentioned. It's the IJCSCL 2006 paper titled something like Technology Affordances for Intersubjective Meaning Making, an Agenda for CSCL, where I discuss these more. Just for some examples here, let's say, you know, CSCL, we're looking at learning in groups. So groups might be, how can groups be a setting of learning? Well, they can be a setting of learning because the group stimulates individuals somehow. There's the passing information between heads. You get this together with somebody. Somebody knows something you don't know, and then through talking, that information gets transferred. Or if you're more of a constructivist kind of theorist, that all knowledge is constructed by the individual in their interaction with the environment, trying to stay in equilibrium, and so on, the Piagetian tradition. Then the group as a setting might stimulate learning, might stimulate the individual's constructions through the interactions they have with others. And that can involve conflict, or it can involve encountering ideas that are not in conflict with what your ideas are, but that elaborate on them, new experiences that you have to take an account of. So those are more like individual agents of learning, those two. Co-constructing meaning is more the small group is the agent of learning, and that learning involves something that happens in the intersubjective space in between people. But we can also see learning as more a community affair. A group might be part of a community of practice, for example, and so the community might learn by changing their practices through their experiences, acquiring better ways of doing things. And then individuals, communities replicate themselves by taking on new members. So individuals learn in a sense by taking on a role in a community and developing an identity as a community member. So changes in identity and perceptions of self-efficacy in a certain setting and so on are all also valid views of what learning is. So, you know, it's potentially very rich. I have a couple other examples here that are kind of cut across what I just said, but kind of to make the point that although it looks like the two lists I have, individual, small group, and networks as agents, and then acquisition, intersubjective meaning making, and participatory as epistemologies, it looks like those two lists match up strictly. But these examples are intended to show that you can have different epistemologies at different granularities. So if you're following through on the web page. I'm on the some other examples list here. So individual epistemologies. Actually, that was what I was supposed to say. Acquisition, I think. Yeah, that was. I copied this off a slide before I fixed that. Yeah, acquisition epistemologies. So learning as acquiring something. So you can of course see that in small groups and in individuals in small groups as being the agent of learning. Like somebody explains something to somebody, now I understand it. An individual practices something, they acquire a skill. But you can also see the acquisition epistemologies in at the network level. It's not strictly an individual thing. So for example, the theory of weak ties, which is, there's a paper by Granovetter called The Strength of Weak Ties, which is the most cited paper in the social sciences. By the way, that paper was rejected the first several times it was submitted until they changed the title, and so don't give up. the idea of weak ties is that your connections to other peoples that who are not strong ties, not your, you know, your mother, your spouse, your children, but rather just people you know, are sources of information. And then you can, the strength of weak ties is that these links in a network give you access to information that you may not normally have access to through your strong ties, the people you interact with on a regular basis. So this is an acquisition epistemology because it has to do with getting information, acquiring something, but it happens at a network level. Theories of diffusion of innovations is another theory that I see as being an acquisition epistemology at the network level. And that's more, I've encountered that more in like the MIS, Management Information Systems literature, or in the popular press as well. Then there's intersubjective epistemology. Let's see, I'm just checking the chat here. Is there anything I need to attend to in the chat? Leon got back in, great. Okay. So intersubjective epistemologies have to do with learning is not just an individual acquiring something in their head, but learning is something that happens between people, that new things are constructed in their interaction. So of course, you can see this in studies, argumentation, co-construction, particularly Jerry Stahl's work on group cognition and Tim Koshman. But then this, you see these epistemologies also at a network level. So intersubjective meaning making, where you're collectively coming up with something new. And I think that the best example in the CSCL literature is knowledge building, the work by Scardamalia and Breiter, where they actually contrast knowledge building with learning. They say learning is the acquisition of the existing cultural capital of a group by an individual, whereas knowledge building is the construction of new cultural capital by the group. So they distinguish that from learning, but I'm working here with a broader conception of learning, considering different granularities of agents as the units of change. Okay, so participatory epistemologies. This is where learning is, rather than acquiring something or coming up with new ideas, it's more changes in social participation and identity. And of course, you see this in the first book on LPP, Legitimate Peripheral Participation, really emphasized apprenticeship, that learning is involves an individual relationship between a mentor and a mentee, or an apprentice and the master, whatever you want to call them. But of course, participatory epistemologies, they work at both levels. It's all about how communities of practice replicate themselves and replicate their practices and coordinate across sites and so on. Wenger's 1998 book is a very rich read on communities of practice. So I've just gone over three granularities of agency: individual, small group, and networks. And three epistemologies of what the process of learning is, acquiring something, whether it's knowledge or skills, constructing something new together in the intersubjective interaction, and changes in participatory structures and identity. And so one claim I would make is that, and maybe this is kind of obvious, but learners participate in all of these simultaneously. It's a complex phenomenon. So, you know, the actual experience of somebody being a learner is going to include acquiring, you know, the individual acquiring facts, skills, interacting with others to understand and their changing role in a community and so on. So if we really wanted to understand learning, then we'd have to take on this question of how it takes place through the interplay between individual and collective agencies, and being interested in the role of technology, I would say, in the context of socio-technical networks, networks that include people and artifacts. And this level, this requires a level of research that you rarely see. It's just too hard. I wouldn't recommend that the PhD students, you know, start with something narrow and then get good at it and then figure out how to expand. It's probably the best approach. But if you really want to take on kind of multi-level analysis and theorizing, maybe just pick two things and figure out how they relate to each other. Don't try to cover all this stuff at once. That's, you know, one danger listening to somebody like me is then you want to include everything in your dissertation, and usually most proposals, the first advice I have to give almost everybody who writes a proposal is you're trying to do too much, narrow it down. Yet as a field, CSCL perhaps needs to take this on. How does learning take place through the interplay between these different levels of agency and through these different processes, epistemologies, we might call them. Okay, let's see, I'm going to pause just for a drink here, and if anybody wants to say anything.
Okay, thanks, Dan, for this first input for the discussion. There were a couple of questions in the chat, and I wonder if, Natalie, and I will maybe voice the point for Joe, if you could, and also Greg, if you would like to voice your point in the and broadcast that to everyone and to Dan, so he might respond to that right now.
Okay, so yeah, I'm looking at the chat. Natalie is interested in levels of support, how to support agency without stifling it. Yeah, I'm going to get into that later when I talk about the role of technology as guide and issues that some people have with what's now called scripting research. That's a big issue. And then Greg, yes, Natalie adds, might Scardamalian Brider's ideas be a more creative, quote-unquote, epistemology? I don't know whether you're proposing a fourth category to add to my list, but certainly it is a, just like a small group intersubjective meeting making creates new things, knowledge building does it at the community level. And so I think creativity is an important part of what I was calling intersubjective meaning making. It can be intersubjective at different granularities of numbers of people involved. Let's see, Greg, let's see, let me scroll back here. How joint conception of problem is raked to grounding and how that's related to a place no place critique. Let's see, what's the right place to insert this one? So joint conception of a problem, of course, is people in their interaction, they engage in various ways of checking that they understand each other. Grounding is one term that's a term used for a process is in a theory called contribution theory. I think Greg knows all this, but I'm just making sure everybody's on the same page. So Clark, there's a, my favorite paper on this is by Clark and Brennan. I think it's in the Distributed Cognition books, 1991, but I'm not sure about that. So grounding is a process where people who are interacting are drawing inferences about what they share with the other person, what's called common ground. So like just because you're, all of you, many of you whom I have not met, I already know that you're in graduate school. Just by knowing that, there's a lot of things I can assume that we share, you know, values, knowledge, and so on. But then there's more specific things in common ground that we share, which is through the interaction, we I might say something, you might react to it. I take that reaction. Yeah, that's it. He just posted the paper. I take the reaction of evidence of your understanding or not understanding what I just said. And the evidence can be as simple as nodding or even not doing anything, not interrupting, just continuing to attend. Or the evidence can be really explicit. But then the idea is through the interaction, we build up mental models of each other's mental models, basically, that I have an idea of what I think that you know or are aware of that I do as well, and then we can build on this. So this is kind of getting a little bit detailed here, so maybe I'll try to wrap it up quickly. But the critique that Greg is referring to, the place with no place, there's an article by Tim Koshman, and I don't remember the citation for this one, but I've talked to Tim in person about this a lot too, that it's called contribution theory because it's a theory about how people make contributions to conversations, and common ground is what you base your contributions on, and the process of grounding is this process of evaluating evidence of what the other person understands. So Tim Koshman's critique, there's a good citation was just posted, is that it's a place with no place, that there's this idea that we have this shared pool of propositions that we both believe we share, but there isn't really any place that these propositions exist. And this is very much an ethnomethodological kind of critique. So ethnomethodology, I could digress even further here, but it's not ethnography, it's not a methodology, it is the ology, study of the methods or practices of an ethnos. So it's how the methods by which a group of people accomplish things is ethnomethodology. And that's where Tim is coming from. And he's saying, well, we can't just assume that there's this place where we have shared propositions, our shared propositions are stored, and we can say, oh yeah, you know that, I got that stored there. We have to continually check an interaction. So it's a process of interaction. And Frank's got his hand up. So I'm going to get off this diversion and get back onto my main track, having answered that question.
Thanks, Dan. So this was quite specific already. Thanks. There was one question by Joe. Maybe that's also important for other PhD students. So how is that related, or where would you put in Lev Vygotsky into this? How is that related to his socio-cultural perspective on learning? Where is he in your epistemology?
Yes, well, I can tell already I got way too much prepared here. some of this was going to come up later. I was going to discuss sociocultural analyses as one of the four main traditions of CSCL as I now see it. In terms of the agency and epistemology, I would say Vygotsky was an incredibly big thinker. Him and his colleagues weren't just trying to come up with a one-off theory that addresses one small phenomenon. He was basically trying to address much or all of human experience, and he was trying to bridge between the psychological and the social realms. So I think Vygotsky would say, well, of course, agency is both. You see in his ideas about the first law of genetic development, I think it's called the internalization, that anything that's in the psychological realm, the psychic or whatever you call that realm, first appears on the social realm. So you see how the child interacts with the mother, or certain kinds of social interactions get internalized. So we're bridging between levels of agency here. What I just said kind of sounds like an acquisition epistemology, but I don't think I would peg Vygotsky to just acquisition. Perhaps I don't want to digress too much on that, but yeah, I think I'll stop that. I'll get back to sociocultural things a little bit later. Actually, that was, let me check the screen here. We don't have any hands up. Okay. Let me go into the next section, is methodological and empirical traditions. I just mentioned that I see kind of four traditions in CSCL. When I wrote that 2006 paper, I think I had three, but so one thing about CSCL is very diverse. It's You know, there's a lot of discussions about can we think of this as a single field, or is it just the people who happen to go to this conference and publish in this journal? So we've got very strong component of CSCLs in the experimental paradigm, roots in cognitive and educational psychology, has strengths in that the conventional view is it's strengths that you can make causal claims because you do studies controlling variables, and if you change one variable and see another variable change, then you can make a causal claim about that. By the way, there are people in the qualitative research tradition that kind of dispute that experimentalism is the only way to make causal claims. Some of them say, well, experimental studies just show you, even if you, it's more than correlation, but it's still just covariance. It doesn't show you the means by which one thing affects another. So one critique is that a qualitative analysis will show the actual pathways of influence. And I got another spelling error there. I typed this all really fast. So some other critiques of experimentalism are that it abstracts from actual behaviors and accomplishments, so it might not see how things are actually done, because by coding things and counting up variables and then adding them up and dealing with pools of variance, you have aggregated together a lot of really specific ways that people have done specific things. And that also relates to the question of ecological validity. Another very strong tradition is, I'll go down to the third one, interaction analysis. This is where that critique comes from, one place it comes from, which has roots in conversation analysis and ethnomethodology. I've already discussed that a bit in talking about Tim's work. So they look at how, Tim has a paper called How Do, emphasis, People Learn? How do people go about doing learning? That he wants us to study how learning is accomplished in practice. So they would want to look more at the actual accomplishments of people in a particular situation. But of course, they're subject to the critique of it's not generalizable, which experimental paradigm is stronger on. There's also people who are more in an iterative design paradigm and design-based research. And this tradition draws on the other ones. Some of it's, I'm kind of, you know, making a list here, making things appear like they're cleanly separated. So here I say the roots are in computer science and human-computer interaction. It's not that clean, you know, it comes from education as well. But here the idea is to continuously improve artifacts that are used for learning in the setting of the learning. And so you work closely with the practitioner, you do observation of what's happening, it's not just engineering, empirical engineering, you're also changing theory as you change the artifacts in practice. So your theory is expressed in the artifacts in a sense, and when you see something happen, that might lead you to change theory. So that's another tradition. And then finally, the fourth one is the sociocultural tradition, sometimes called CHAT, Cultural Historical Activity Theory. And this tradition tends to look more at the bigger picture of the setting, institutional, cultural, and historical processes, different time scales, and how artifacts, that term is meant very broadly, besides, you know, like a hammer is an artifact, also a word is an artifact. You know, in biology you have taxonomies, those are artifacts, those are tools. Tools actually is what the word I really meant to use there. Tools can be conceptual things as well as physical things. They can be practices. So how do these tools pass on across time scales what has been learned by a culture? And then how does that influence the macro and mesoscale infrastructures that result influence learning in specific settings? So a sociocultural analysis, you might look at what's happening in a particular classroom, but say, well, this relates to these traditions, these artifacts come from these other places, and it just occurred to me that there's something kind of Latourian about that, Latourian actor network theory, but I don't think I will go there now. The idea that actor network theory is really big on the idea that something happening at different times and places kind of stream together to influence what happens in a particular setting. So if you want to understand what's happening in a particular setting, you need to look at kind of all these influences from other times and places that come via artifacts. So one big issue for CSCL is, well, there's all these methodological traditions, and there's all these different conceptions of learning. Who's the agent? What's the epistemology? How can we make any sense of this? Is this diversity a strength, or is it just a cacophony of voices that don't come together in any coherent way? And here I can put in a pitch for a book that's coming out that we've had this. Chris Lund is one of the other leaders of this project and co-editors of the book, along with Carolyn Rose and Nancy Law and Chris Teplovs, and Gregory Dyke was also very involved in it. We had a series of five workshops at conferences and Alpine rendezvous where we had people from different traditions analyze the same data. Actually, our process evolved over time, and that's a whole nother story that I can't get into now, but we gradually realized what we were trying to do, and that what we were trying to do was to figure out how to get these different traditions to talk to each other productively. So the multivocality is that there's these different traditions, mythological and theoretical, and how do we do something productive? And we came up with strategies for that. We also encountered limitations where you can't always get everybody to understand each other. The point is not to get everybody to agree with each other. The point is to get people to understand each other enough that they can get something out of the other person's point of view, but you may still disagree. So that's a book that's coming out. It's in press now, and we'll be appearing at the conferences next summer. So I think I pause briefly here for another drink and.
So now would be time for comments and questions. I would have at least one question then. I think you were, or maybe it might also be a question to everyone. The balkanization aspect, I think that is really true as long as, the different methodological traditions also select different phenomena to study. And I think what you did with the multivocality project is give a model, and therefore I'm really happy that this book will be out soon, give a model that you can also focus on the same phenomenon. I think the main problem, or it is a problem of balkanization, because typically the reaction is that, if you have a different methodological tradition, if you are in a different tradition, you typically also have a different tradition of phenomena that you're studying.
Yeah, that is definitely true. And this is where we run into some of the difficult to resolve issues. We were able to recruit people to this project from a number of different traditions, including more experimental, we weren't doing experiments, we were more analyzing data corpora, recordings of collaborative learning interactions, but there were quantitative studies, there were people doing more interaction analysis, interpretive, there was social network analysis, including network analysis of concepts, as well as people looking at multimedia, multimodal, and so on. We were missing the sociocultural tradition. We weren't able to recruit anybody from that. Or we didn't really get any data from workplaces. But other than that, I thought we have pretty rich coverage. But to Frank's point, though, sometimes the differences in the traditions themselves make it hard to study the same phenomenon. Like if you do interaction analysis, and I've been on Tim Koshman's one of his data fests where you bring 2 minutes of video and you play it, and 15 seconds in somebody says stop, and you spend the next hour talking about that first 15 seconds and you never get to see the rest of the video. Whereas you get a statistician come along and says, yeah, I need enough data to make statistical inferences. So how can you have data that those two traditions both work on? So that's one issue we encountered. One answer to that I've tried in my own lab. I've had students who are doing microanalysis and students who are doing network analysis. I picked a focal event, like a particular session where teachers were interacting with each other in this online network. And I asked the people who were doing the microanalysis to look at that event, but then the people who were doing analysis that requires more data to say, okay, do your analysis of people's role changes over time or whatever, and then plunk this event in there and say how your bigger picture analysis informs what's happened here. So that's kind of the multi-level thing that if larger scale analysis are informative, they might be brought to bear on understanding a particular event. And that's actually what we mentioned earlier, you know, that sociocultural view, macro and meso level structures influence the micro, and actor network theory, and so on. Let's see. But yeah, you're right that also what is the phenomenon worth studying, I think, is a big issue too. I'm sure you, of course, you've run into this, that you do experimental studies, and then some people think that what happens in the experimental lab just isn't interesting because it's not ecologically valid, quote unquote. It's not a real world situation, and so we have to kind of bridge that gap as well. Okay, let's see. I'm just checking the chat here. All right. Oh yes, I meant to. Yeah, Chris pointed out that I mentioned the productive multivocality, and we do have one of these webinars in April on productive multivocality that I think Chris and Carolyn and I are doing together. Chris is leading it. Okay, so the next section I had here is.
sorry to interrupt. Then maybe we could have a quick round of so everyone telling us what the perspective is right now. So LMU, Natalie Spence, and Joe Vasilis. If you could just quickly give us some feedback where you are now, what your questions are up to that point, please.
Oh, so I should stop broadcasting because you're asking other people to jump in here.
Just adding to the idea of balkanization, even when you're doing the same sort of analysis, a lot of the studies that you see are very limited. They're in one class or just in one specific subject. And a lot of them are in educational studies because the people doing the research are teaching educational students. It seems like a big problem in that it's not such, you're not covering such a wide area as you would like to, and there's I suppose how the various studies can be compared, what's the basis of comparison between them, I guess.
Okay, I guess I'm not sure if that's a question or a point. Yes, there's issues of the basis of comparison between studies done in different settings and at different granularities. I think, you know, one issue we have in the learning sciences is replication. You know, everybody's got to do something new. So if nobody's trying to do the same thing, you can't get that published, then it's hard for us to connect our work. And you see replication more in the experimental paradigm than other paradigms, where you're trying to study a similar thing to see if you get similar results or do variations on it. But I'm not sure exactly whether you were focusing in on different settings or something else. We got a hand up here, so I'll stop. You want to try that one more time? Or we just lost, we just lost Leon. He went off the screen. Okay, well, I suppose I should go on until they come back. I got two more kind of groups of things I was going to talk about, and we don't have to talk about them. We could go into discussion, but I just kind of go through them briefly, stopping after the first one. One was the role of artifacts in CSCL, which has been my focus of research. And then I had more for the people who are being introduced to this field. I had kind of a list of topics and issues that are current in CSCL, which I don't mind if we don't get to it, but it's there if we need it. So I already talked about CSCL. There's different conceptions of learning, but what about different conceptions of supports, computer support? So of course, computer is any technology. We already talked about that. So what is the support? Now, one obvious thing is it's the interaction medium that, okay, it's computer supported because we're at a distance and we have to do what we're doing now. We have to use some kind of medium. Okay, Leon is back, so I guess I'll hold that thought. Leon, I'm going to get into the role of artifacts next, but maybe you have a comment in context. So, did you go away again? Their hand came up and they went away again. I guess I will just have to pick them up at the end of this section here. Oh, they're back again. Okay, this is your last chance, Leon. Chris, okay.
Sorry, I was wondering if there's not a risk of balkanization when a paper gets evaluated with one methodology and one epistemology, which is not the same as the one you're using. For instance, once I submitted something and one of the comments was, I don't understand your coding system, but I didn't even code. So yeah.
Yeah, okay. I won't comment on the specific situation, but the more general point of reviewing across disciplines, I'm an associate editor with CSCL, the journal, and that's something we deal with a lot, and also the Journal of Learning Sciences. I had a paper under review, and it was an ethnomethodological study, and it was reviewed by experimentalists, and so I had the same question, but one answer is that because we have this diverse audience, you have to make your work understandable to people from different traditions. But that is, that's really, I think, an editor's job. You have to realize, don't assign a paper to somebody who has an axe to grind about, who's absolutely adamantly against the tradition the paper's from. You need open-minded reviewers. And it's a different writing for that kind of journal than it is writing for a more disciplinary, constrained journal, like experimental psychology journal. You don't have to explain certain things that you might have to explain in another journal. That's what I have to say about that. I'm going to go back to the artifacts thing. So I was just pointing out, sometimes CSCL is seen as, well, it's really distance learning. It's learning through technology as a medium. And then this leads to the inevitable comparisons to face-to-face. There's some website somewhere called No Significant Difference where it's gathered together hundreds, possibly now thousands of studies comparing face-to-face to online learning and typically finding no significant difference. And the guy's point is, hey, maybe we got the conclusion here and we can stop. But there's some problems with seeing CSCL as it's mainly CMC, and we should evaluate CSCL in terms of how close do we get to the rich face-to-face interaction is the gold standard. One, of course, is we're not necessarily doing it through computer-mediated communication or CMC. Classic work in CSCL has been face-to-face. The Knowledge Forum, the Scarter-Mailand Brider's work, or CSIL, the CSILE, Computer-Supported Intentional Learning Environment, was embedded in a classroom. Jeremy Rochelle's dissertation, which was hugely influential, was two people sitting down in front of a simulation. Another point is that distance matters, as the title of a paper by Olson and Olson puts it. There's a lot of work showing how interacting at a distance has issues that aren't going to be resolved anytime soon. Really fundamental things like, we can get a huge wall and high bandwidth, we can see everybody in the room and it's very high resolution and the audio is working perfectly, but we're still in different spaces. So if I gesture in the space I'm in, my gesture may not be oriented towards the objects that I'm gesturing at in the same way you are, where there's all these subtle things about interaction that you just can't replicate. So distance does matter, but then there's the view that we shouldn't necessarily try to achieve perfect virtual reality. First of all, if we just replicated being together, okay, great, that's a wonderful achievement, But we still got the question of how do we support learning? You know, just being together doesn't provide a learning agenda or a process. And finally, there's a nice paper by Holland and Stornetta way back. This is like 89 or 91 in the CHI conference called Beyond Being There. And it was arguing for technology has certain affordances of interaction that are preferable to face-to-face. So they're, you know, this is very old work, but the, you know, visionary. They're saying we're going to we'll succeed when we figure out ways to make technology do things that we would prefer to do it through technology rather than seeing it as a poor substitute for face-to-face. So I want to set that aside. Technology is an interaction medium because that's not all there is. There's also technology as a guide, which you can also see as a constraint. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that there's this paradox of collaborative learning. We know that interacting with other people has benefits. And that goes back to the stuff I talked about earlier. You know, other people have different information, so the multiple heads paradigm, you know, two heads are better than one. Interacting with other people makes you think about things. You can brainstorm, you construct things together. But with that benefit, the extra overhead, what some people call socio-cognitive load. It's like cognitive load, but it's also load on the social system to manage that interaction with others. So we've got this benefit, but we've got the cost. And so by offloading part of this work to the technology does some of the work for us, then we can benefit from the other parts. Then, of course, you want to have some means of possibly, if you want people to get better at doing all this stuff together, you have some means of fading or removing that support. But that's another issue. But as I said before, just being face-to-face isn't enough to learn. Learners may not know what to do. A nice example is when people are getting really good at building simulations. So they built these micro-worlds and said, well, people will learn by just exploring, say, learn physics by throwing objects around in this virtual world and changing the laws of physics and seeing how things move. And they were fun to play with, but the problem was that again, learners don't necessarily have an agenda for how to learn, and so then the idea of guided discovery is, well, let them do the exploration, but you've got to guide them. So technology can provide this kind of guide. Now, one thing I've realized in talking about this is that some of these solutions aren't specific to technology. They're more about instructional design, and they can be accomplished, say, on paper. So, you know, a question then is this CSCL research, or is this more generally education research, and what really belongs in CSCL? So in my 2006 paper, I point this out, and then I ask the question, what is really specific to CSCL as a field? And, of course, big surprise, I make a pitch for what I was focusing on. Which I call technology affordances for intersubjective meaning making. At the time, I was probably, that was when I was most influenced by Tim Koshman and looking at small group processes and looking at how the representational tools or the software environments I gave students affected how they interacted with each other. The work, you may have heard the name of the software was Belvedere, which started way back in the 90s when I was working with Alan Lesgold in Pittsburgh. But I did a series of studies that were experimental studies at first, designing different software interfaces. For example, just you share a plain text editor. There's no particular guidance there, but it's very expressive. Or you have a matrix where you can put ideas along the rows and columns and you can check off relationships between them. Or you have a graph. You put ideas in as nodes in the graph, and then you try to link ideas that are related somehow. You know, this is concept mapping. Ours were actually called evidence maps because they were data, hypotheses, and evidential relations. And I did some experimental studies showing how the affordances of these technologies, or what the actions they make easier to carry out, affected what the small groups did. And so I studied this phenomenon in the experimental paradigm, but then a reviewer said, "Hey, you're not really looking at collaboration. You're just looking at numbers." And I thought, "Yeah, he's right. He or she is right." And I started working more in the interaction analysis paradigm and examining what people actually did with my software, which I found to be very interesting. So whether you're in experimental paradigm or in the interaction analysis paradigm, my argument here is that a key, a core concern of CSCL that's unique to CSCL, that distinguishes it from just any other education research, is this design of social technologies that offer affordances for action that influence what groups do. And I just realized I haven't really said what affordances are. I think that comes later, actually. But so affordances, it comes out of vision, a theory of vision by Gibson, and I should be careful not to digress too much here. The basic idea is that an affordance is a relationship between an actor and its environment that enables action. Gibson was talking about animals in a natural environment, and they would afford actions like grasping or running across or sitting or something like that. And so we can think of this in terms of technology designs, that technologies offer certain ways of acting. They're not deterministic. Technology doesn't determine what we do. We make choices. But nor are they completely irrelevant. We may be influenced to choose certain actions in certain technological settings because those actions are made easier or more available. And I'm not talking today at all about my work on that. That's a whole, I cited a paper that in the Knowledge Cartography book that's on this webpage that reviews all that work. But the basic idea is I'm arguing for this, looking at the interaction between the affordances of the technologies and the group interactions is a potential key focus of CSCL. And I listed some ways in which technology affordances are relevant specifically to group action. Not once when I was early in the phase of this work, I wrote up something and Mickey Chi asked me, well, what's specific to groups? Why isn't this, you know, just anything that's true in any situation? And so I came up with some of these ideas and added to them later. So technologies can affect group learning and problem-solving activities in ways including immutable mobiles. Latour has this idea of inscriptions, or like a map is something that you can construct a representation of something, carry it somewhere else, and recruit other people into your project. I guess I'm not going to say a whole lot about that. I think mutable mobiles is more the idea here, that you can influence people at different times and places and bring people into your learning project through mutable mobiles or immutable mobiles. See my 2006 paper for elaboration. negotiation potentials. These are the two core ones, negotiation potentials and referential resources. So if you create, say, the matrix or a plain text editor or a graph editor, some tool that has primitives out of which learners construct representations of what they're learning. And this is distinguished from the information visualization literature. It's not what somebody visualizes for you. It's how you construct representations of your own understanding. And the tool offers the potential of carrying out a certain action. Like, for example, there's a couple of nodes on the screen. One stands for a hypothesis, another stands for a data item, and they're not linked, and you could link them. Often what I saw learners doing when they're in groups is that they would see that the action was potentially there and then negotiate whether they should do that. You know, should we link that to that? And then they would have a discussion. So the fact that the tool offered the potential for carrying out an action led to negotiations. In CMC, I saw it was kind of reversed. If it was like they're typing in chat, they would do something and then it would say, was that a good idea? Because it was just easier for them to refer to something that they had done rather than the potential for something. Referential resources. Once you've constructed something in a representation, that, you know, an object on the screen can stand for a complex idea that's hard to say verbally, and you can just express the idea through gesturing. So we can design tools that offer the referential resources that we want learners to, that make it easy to reference the things we want learners to attend to. So this is kind of a subtle design issue of how do we influence their interaction. And there's others like integrating over time and space that Pierre Dillenberg once said that CMC turns communication into substance, that Your communication can be recorded, and that can be a resource for study later on, for connecting things you did across time and space. Reflecting subjectivity is the idea that we can design technologies to make other people's positions or solutions, views visible, and then you can see, you can contrast them. You can also make technology make it easier to be aware of other people's activity. So activity awareness helps you choose if you wish to coordinate with the others. So these are all different ways in which I think a core agenda for CSCL is looking at how designs of technologies through their affordances and through these means I've just discussed can influence group activity in ways that leads to learning in a way that's less kind of rigid than some other approaches that are taken. But that's a whole nother, I know you're having probably another session on scripting. I can take a pro and con view of scripting right now. But I should take a little break here to see if anybody has said a lot. If anybody has.
Hi. Do you hear me? So I got
you
a question.
Reply.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you can't reply anyway. So I got a question about what you said about videotaping the collaboration. So did you have any experiences with that? Like videotape someone who's engaged in CSCL and make it usable for others to kind of get information out of the dialogue?
A clarifying question. Okay, so you mean how to make your videos more accessible to other researchers?
If someone is engaged in CSCL, like talking about maths or arguing about maths, and you just videotape them and you just give these videos to others, is it fruitful for them to learn how to engage into CSCL, how to do mathematics?
So it sounds like you're saying using videos for modeling. I don't think you're saying for teacher instruction. That videos of classroom activity are very useful for teacher instruction. Yeah, Chris is saying it's vicarious learning. I have not studied that. I think Nicole Rumo has studied that. I vaguely recall she had some paper on the role of videos. And Frank, do you remember anything about that? He just put in her name. Okay, I'll.
Yeah, just typed in her name. I think she was using video conferences actually, but there was some modeling included. I think there is a line of research that is not specific for CSCL that comes to my mind. That is with respect to research on eye tracking when people learn with technologies and show other people the eye gazes of others to model certain search behavior or something like that. I have not a direct association for CSCL for that.
Okay, does anybody else have questions or comments at this point? Have I just overwhelmed you with too much talk?
I had a question just to clarify reflecting subjectivity. Do you mean that the computing environment records what different people have said, so you see the subjective view of other people, so you're seeing other points of view, that sort of thing?
I'm cheating here. I'm looking at my paper to remember what I said, because I had a list of different things here. But the awareness that others are present and will evaluate your own actions will influence what you do. Just the awareness that you're listening to me, of course, affects what I do right now. Attentional status. So actually, this has been seen in workplace studies when they changed There is what they called war rooms for certain kinds of industries where they have all these engineers working in a room, and they had these big monitors, and you could glance over there and see what the other team was working on, and that enabled certain kinds of coordination. And then when they tried to over automate things and replaced it with small displays, it screwed everything up. So there's this kind of that kind of awareness of what other people are doing. But then there's more things more specific to learning, like you know, visualizing conflict or agreement. One thing I did years ago, I had a student, Angles Constantino, Constantino Gonzalez in Mexico, did a study. Well, she wanted to develop agents for coaching collaboration, and the problem area was entity relationship modeling, which is basically you're drawing diagrams, you know, boxes and arrows, to model what your database is going to be structured like in a domain. And she would have different students make their solutions first. This is a really common paradigm in CSCL, it's not special to her. You know, have people make their individual solutions first and then put them together, and then you can see you know, differences between individual solutions. So that's something that, again, this is another thing you don't need computers for. You know, what do we mean by technologies? Oh, another really good example, James Caput, who did really great work in mathematics. He was unfortunately died too young, was hit by a truck while running. He used to do work where individuals solving a mathematical problem, their solutions were all projected into a single space. Like you would see your graph in other people's graphs, and this personalized the mathematics. It's like, that's me up there, and people, he saw this in their language, that you know, why are you going up that way? The students discussing things with each other. So in a way, making the mathematics subjective through that. Of course, you know, there's embedding self. This is a very broad category. I saw all these things, and I realized they all have to do with awareness between people, or awareness of yourself in relation to other people in the content domain that can be reflected by visualizations. And Frank has posted something on modeling through eye tracking. I'm not familiar with the work he's citing there, but that's my big list. Maybe we got 10 minutes left. Maybe I can say something that might get some reactions here. My last section is on major areas of research in CSCL, and I already talked about, there's one called affordances there, and I already talked about that in relation to my own work, that I think we need to study affordances as things that influence people but don't necessarily determine what they do, and study those influences. Another point on that list is small groups are a great locus for of study. This is a point Jerry has made. When people talk to each other, they're externalizing their thinking. You don't have to remind them to do that, like in think aloud protocols, they'll do it naturally. And also, small groups sit at the boundary of individual and collective learning. You know, people internalize what they experience in small groups, and then practices from small groups may be adopted at larger collective levels. So that's an argument for a particular line of work in CSCL. I see a hand up. I was going to next get into my discussion of scripting, just so you know, that's what I'm going to do next. And I'll probably end with the challenge of networked individualism, but we'll go to the what Leon has to say.
Hi again. I wanted to ask something about this paradox of collaborative learning and the idea that interaction management, it's all about costs, but maybe that could also be part of the learning process, to learn how to manage an interaction. And maybe that's two kind of different ways to see what kind of role technologies may play.
Okay, I'm sorry. I started to type what you were saying, and then I missed the second part of what you said. What you were asking me about the paradox of collaborative learning. Could you just say that one more time?
Yeah, I was wondering. You said we need to offload the costs of interaction management, but maybe part of the learning should be learning how to manage an interaction, And then how can technologies also address this IT and not just offloading these costs?
Yeah, that's actually something I was going to mention in the scripting context, but whenever we offer support, then the question is the support permanent or temporary? Some prosthetics become a permanent part of our practice, even if they were originally offered just to make something easier. Imagine offering calculators for students who are learning mathematics, just so for now they don't have to worry about doing long division, and then they'll do it later. But then eventually people realize, well, it's a lot easier just to use the calculator, forget doing the long division by hand. I think that is, we have this, I could branch off here into a discussion of power relationships. You know, there's really different views of power in some of these different traditions. You know, who has the right and the agency to set their learning agenda? There's some views that learning is just free exploration, but then, of course, in formal education, there's things we want people to know or be able to do, and then we've got too many of them at once, so we say, okay, we're going to focus on this one first, and we'll scaffold the other part, and then we'll fade that scaffolding, and people then will acquire that other skill, so now they can do the whole thing themselves. I think technology can play a role in that, but again, my comment about sometimes when the scaffolding is too good, it becomes part of the new practices, and maybe that's a way that learning research contributes to changing practices. But this also connects to the other thing I was going to get into, which was what I titled Designing to Encourage Effective Learning Practices. So a lot of research in CSCL, or a lot of research in collaborative learning, has studied what leads to learning in collaborative groups, and they study things like group composition and tasks and so on, but there's processes are a part of it. So, for example, in argumentation research, it's important to make clear what kind of statement you're making and whether you're challenging somebody. It's important to state the grounds for your claims so that other people can evaluate them and so on. So there's these things we know people should do, but they don't always necessarily do. So this is a reason for having what's called scripts, and there's different kinds of scripts, like collaboration scripts is one kind where you, a script is, I have a chapter discussing scripting, and there's different conceptions. In psychology, a script is a mental thing that, Shanks scripts are mental structures that control how we do things. In computer science, a script is more like a process guide, and CSCL, a script is anything that structures the interaction in a way that's considered to be beneficial for learning. So we identify some kind of process we want people to engage in, and we make a script to support that process. And there's been a lot of research on scripting. If you're new to CSCL, you're going to see a lot of this, and possibly they have a session scheduled on this, but like one paper I remember was asking, is it better to script the interaction or script the epistemological reasoning? And I think that the conclusion was it's better to script the collaborative interaction, probably from the point of view of the offloading, that now you don't have to worry about who does what, and you can focus on the epistemological. And so that has to do with, if you want people to learn to be able to work in groups solving problems, they're going to have to eventually deal with both the collaboration and the core problem itself. But maybe if you script the collaboration, then they can learn the difficult epistemological skills and then acquire the collaboration skills later. So there's all these, there's a lot of different issues there. So there's the issue of fading of scripts. Are scripts internalized? Do people then internalize, like if you set up role structures, do they then internalize those roles? And then there's concerns about overscripting, which I think is getting back to the question I was just asked, is does scripting prevent people from learning metacognitive skills? A similar issue has come up in the tutoring systems world, where the cognitive tutors out of Pittsburgh will keep the students strictly following, it's called model tracing. They have a model of the expert solution, and the student is not allowed to go more than one step off of that model. And they show great learning gains you know, pretest, post-test designs. It was considered one of the first successes of intelligent tutoring systems, but it was also critiqued for saying, well, the students aren't learning metacognitive skills. So that's a whole area of research that you'll see a lot in CSCL and some issues about whether it's good or not. And there's a hand up, so I'm going to pass it to LMU.
Hello, I'm Carlos from LMU. And I want to ask three questions. The first one is I want to know if CSCL has been done with video games. The second one, I want to know if you will see games as tools or as scaffolding, like tools that will need external scaffolding in order for them to be, like for people to learn from them, or if they can be a scaffolding by themselves. And the third question is if you think that video games can be CSCL or only like CSL, like without the collaborative part, like it will be more individual.
Okay. Okay, I'm trying to parse this as three different questions. I see some overlap between the first and the third. Can you do CSCL with video games is the first, and are video games CSCL or only CL? Well, depends on the game, but, you know, much, and even in a way it doesn't depend on the game. You know, some games are designed to be collaborative, some are not. But even the ones that are not designed to be collaborative, people are the play of those games is embedded in communities of people who play the game and share knowledge about it. So James Gee's book, you must be familiar with, but if you're not, let's see, how do I have it on my shelf here somewhere? Yes, just a second. It's called What Video Games Have to Teach Us About Learning and Literacy. Excellent book. You probably have read it if you're into gaming, but for those who haven't, you know, he talks about this phenomenon of learning and gaming being embedded in essentially learning communities. So yeah, I think you can do CSCL with video games, and games as tools or scaffolding. A lot of the stuff on representational affordances, that thinking can be applied to game design, and how do you structure games to guide people into certain kinds of interactions that are productive. I'm probably running out of time. Early on, I used to contrast, this was years ago, but contrast Math Blasters, which is where your objective is to shoot stuff and quickly doing math in your head while you shoot stuff, with the logical journey of the Zumbinis, which is a kind of critical thinking game, and the study showing the difference in discourse of groups of playing these two games was so different that, you know, the Zumbinis one was so much more thoughtful. My son is actually now in a program at NYU called Games for Learning that was just started this fall, so I guess I'll be hearing more from him about these questions as well. So I think I'm running out of time. My last point was going to be a challenge of networked individualism, that, you know, CSCL is traditionally focused on these strong relationships, joint conception of a problem, communities of practice, but now we have this new network society that focuses on weak ties, and one question that comes up is, you know, do we expand CSCL to encompass this, or we kind of take a stance to say that joint conception is really important, we don't want to lose that. I'm going to go ahead and stop there and see, take a cue from Frank about what we do next, since we are running towards the end of the time. But if anybody has questions, please do raise your hand.
Well, my suggestion would be if you make a final little input, if you like, and then we make a quick round where everyone just quickly reacts to that session in the sense of what has he or she learned, or is useful for our own research, which kind of epistemological approach they are using so far, and so on. I would have two or three questions also, but I think I would skip that and reduce it to just only one at the very end, if I may. I would have one more general, a little bit more political question that also exceeds or that goes a bit beyond the CSCL content and methodology. So if you go ahead then for another 2 or 3 minutes, then we make the quick round, and then I would use the final 30 seconds for my question and your answer.
I'm actually going to not say anything else. I've said enough, so I'll just pass it on to the round. I hope this was useful for getting ideas, some thinking in CSCL. And let's hear some more questions.
Okay, then thank you very much, Dan. And let's make the quick round. Well, Natalie, Joe, Vasilis and Joe, they will put something into the chat, I guess. Lyon, LMU, twice. Would you quickly say something, react to that?
Hi, Dan. Thank you very much from the LMU for your very nice input, especially about the different epistemology approaches that are within CSCL. And for me, I also took the information about the intelligent tutoring system from Pittsburgh you mentioned, and I'm going to search for that directly after the webinar because this might be related to my work. Thank you.
Hi, we are from LMU. Personally, I think that it has been very enlightening, and some of the cues and paradigms or theories you have said during this conference having can be very, very useful for me for my project. I don't know if you want to say something.
And especially the approach about the interaction analysis is really interesting and really something to always consider, because I think it's a lot about numbers and not so much about interaction. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're one thing to consider is how you mix in a little bit of interaction analysis with other methods, especially I think you're probably in a program that does mostly experimental work, and but mixing in a little interaction analysis to understand what's going on and then to have richer constructs in your experimental work, I think, is a good thing.
Hey, Dan, just to say thank you. We really appreciated listening to you here in Lyon. And we really enjoyed the way that you discussed the foundational issues in CSCL. And I'm going to pass on the floor to Claire, who has a specific thing to say as well.
Hey. Thank you very much. I think it's very useful to have explicit discussion on epistemologies and to have like the global picture of the field or CSL community, so I can see, identify better in which part I'm more involved.
Do I see anything great?
And I'll just add in that I've been in CSL for a few years now and been more on one part, some parts of it, the specific parts of it that interested me to start off with during my PhD, and there I kind of knew about the other parts, but haven't realized until recently exactly how they're collected and how they're relevant to each other. So that today really helped me think more about the holes I have in my understanding of the global picture. So thanks for that.
Thanks for that. Appreciate knowing that it helped.
Okay, so my condensed and very last question would be, what kind of recommendations for PhD students would you have in two respects? One is, if they do research on technology, one of the problems obviously is that you have very quickly, you have old technology. Even during your thesis writing, you will have an outdated technology. What is the issue? What would be a solution for that? And the other thing is, we mentioned the learning sciences, the International Society of the Learning Sciences and the CSCL community in particular. What other communities would you recommend for people interested in CSCL as scientific communities or as scientific associations?
Okay. Huh. That's different than what I thought you were going to ask. recommendations for PhD students. Something you didn't ask about is the whole thing of how does a PhD student navigate. There's all these different ways of doing things, all these different theories, yet you're working with an advisor who has a particular approach, and I do recommend that you first really get good at what your advisor does before you start trying to do everything else. But I do want to see the next generation start to kind of figure out how to combine things a bit more without it keeping them from getting their degree work finished. Let's see. First question was, students who are working with old technologies outdated. Yeah, if your research depends on the specific nature of the technology, it's probably not a strategic good idea. You need to conceptualize your research in a way at a level of abstraction that can be applied to new technologies. Maybe a nice example of this was one of my students, Nathan Dwyer, who finished a while ago, has an article in another issue of the 2006 IJCSCL on analyzing how people appropriate the affordances of communication media, and included paper, people studying, people interacting just through writing things on paper and moving it around, as well as email, wikis. But then he abstracted it to, here's these general strategies, here's affordances that media have, and here's general strategies for appropriating those affordances. And so, you know, if he kept going, he could take that way of looking at it and apply it to new technologies as they develop. So, yeah, my general advice there is make sure that your way of thinking about things, the questions you're asking, the results you're getting, will, it doesn't sound like very profound advice. Make sure you don't have the problem, right? But you can do it by saying, well, one way you can do it is by working backwards, is saying, okay, I've got this way of looking at things. My way of looking at things, does it also apply to paper and pencil? You know, does it generalize between, you know, I'm doing this with these kinds of, you know, whatever it is, iPads, how would it also apply to paper and pencil? And maybe if it generalizes in that direction, maybe it also generalizes forward. I just made up that strategy right now on the spot, so I don't know if it works, but the other question was about learning sciences and what other communities for CSCL. First of all, I want to say that the learning science community is a good one to be involved in. It has some of the best researchers in education and some of the associated fields, and it's a very nice, close community. You develop friends who you see over the years. It's been a really great experience for me. So this is not to say that, you know, one should stray from, there's something wrong with the learning sciences community. There have been issues in the past. You know, there used to be a tension between North America and Europe, and that's a whole other long story. It had to do with the actions of a certain individual renaming a conference without asking anybody permission, which is how the learning sciences started, which led to a lot of animosity and resentment that had to be worked out. But it's a very nice community. If you have a technology focus, I used to go to the AI and Ed conference a lot. At one point, I remember Pierre Dillenberg and I were talking to each other saying, why do we go to this conference? We don't do artificial intelligence anymore. But we were going because the research was still good. I haven't been there for a while, but there might be good stuff there. If you have more of a social kind of or network learning perspective, there is a conference called Network Learning that, frankly, I found it to be a little bit too focused on people complaining about technological determinism because they worked for people who were technological determinists. But then there's this new learning analytics conference I was chair of last year, which I guess maybe the jury is still out on whether it's really going to take off. But I think in terms of interest, it's going to take off because, you know, this, you know, big data and all that stuff is really a hot thing. What the jury is still out on for me is, does it reach the same level of quality of research? So yeah, those are some ideas, and I should let us wrap up here. So I'm sure I'm leaving something out, but whatever, I'm always leaving something out.
Okay, thanks, Dan, for this ad hoc strategy. I think that which is quite good for some PhD students who are now thinking about which technologies to use. There was also a comment by Greg telling that this technology aspect has also to do with different length or durations of PhDs in Europe and the US and maybe also other parts of the world. So, but for now, I think we have to close that session. I would like to really thank you very much, Dan, and also the other participants from different places for the discussion and for the presentation. That was very interesting, and so we covered the basic issues, I think, of CSCL, but also touched on some very specific, very advanced topics. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening. Aloha. Okay, well, I guess this is the part where we say goodbye, so thanks for your thanks, and it was fun.
's. I have to directly move over to another video conference with Jeremy Rochelle, who is already waiting to prepare one of the next sessions. So see you soon. Bye.